The next matter on for oral argument this morning is Kaya v. Jackson. And they're not in the room. Funneling in. Come on forward. The next matter on for oral argument is Kaya v. Jackson, if counsel are both here. I see you're,
Morning, Your Honors.
good morning. I see you going to opposing tables. That's good. That tells us that everybody's here. I'll just let you get situated. I know we're running a little bit early. No rush.
I may have fallen on the way up here, so I'm
Oh,
just
no.
gathering myself. Yeah. No injuries.
No injuries? That's good.
Right.
And no one would have known about it, but now it's on the record. While you're getting situated, and again, there's no rush, I'll just remind you of our rules. Each of you will have 15 minutes to present your argument with additional 5 minutes to appellant's counsel if you'd like to use that time for rebuttal. Those timing restrictions are indicated in the light and clock that's in the lectern, which you can raise or lower to your height at your convenience. There's a button in front that serves a purpose. Please state your name as you commence each leg of your argument because we keep only an audio, not a video recording of the proceedings for the benefit of the public. And with that, counsel, whenever you are ready to go, you may, but again, I'm not trying to rush you. If you need extra time to heal from your tumble.
Thank you.
I apologize on behalf of the building. Judge Smith pointed out to me there's this
No, what
annoying
is that?
buzzing sound. Not sure what that is. I don't know
I apologize. Also, you're going to have a hearing impairment, so I am trying to deal with
if
that
Oh,
right now.
really?
Yeah,
Is that
I have my
difficult?
days, but we'll see how it
All
goes.
right, we'll try to speak. Well, if at any time during the proceeding, if you're having any difficulty hearing either opposing counsel or us, just let us know and we'll try to
Thank
make
you. For
whatever
some reason,
accommodations.
male, it's more than female.
Male boy, I'm sorry. I'll
That's
try to speak with a
what
little.
I'm trying to suggest.
I can go higher. I can go falsetto, but it would be rather embarrassing because the audio recording would only keep track of. Yeah, that could be not good.
Thanks, Your Honor. I
I'll
think we're
come
good
closer to
right
the.
here,
Does it
so.
help if I'm closer to the microphone, or is that just
That
the?
is perfect. You sound great
All right,
to me.
thank you.
Thank you so much. All right. May it please the court, counsel, Victoria Brenner, Brenner, on behalf of appellant Randy Jackson Jr., who is the respondent at this district court. Appellant Randy Jackson Jr. Seeks reversal of the district court's order denying his motion to dismiss the child support enforcement action. The threshold issue in this case, and one that greatly simplifies what might otherwise be a comparison of Japanese and Minnesota child support law for the Uniform Interstate Family Support Act purposes, UIFSA, is that the district court lacked personal jurisdiction over Mr. Jackson.
Can we
Before
just answer the question of where is he domiciled?
Thank you. So at the time of the action, Mr. Jackson viewed his place as South Carolina. That's where he's from. That's where he has his driver's license. As the record reflects, he moved around a good bit as a baseball player, bouncing between Japan, Canada, different states in the United States.
But he considered his domicile in South Carolina.
Correct.
And that's the place that you contend that Ms. Keough was supposed to initiate this action.
Correct. And that was also in the Japanese order. It stated Mr. Jackson's South Carolina address.
Where in he, Mr. Jackson submitted, I think, three affidavits. Is that right?
Yes.
Did any of those affidavits identify that he had a South Carolina driver's license?
He did not in any of his affidavits.
And did so, where is that in the record?
It's in the transcript upon questioning by the district court judge where Mr. Jackson was at that time. He had just 3 days, well, actually, it was about a month before the hearing, had lost his position with the Minnesota Twins. He'd been cut. And Mr. Jackson was, at that point, his significant other and child live in the state of Utah, but he still has all of his contacts are in South Carolina as of that date. He viewed South Carolina as his home.
I guess I want to know what the record evidence is that about South Carolina. So
it really
testify at a hearing?
It is just the, yes, that was at the district court, and that discussion was held at the district court about him really not knowing where he was going to land because he'd just gotten cut, but he viewed South Carolina as his home.
Okay, so that was sworn testimony.
That is sworn testimony.
Okay.
Yeah, that's
that
that
he
testimony.
Viewed South Carolina. And did it say that he had a South, did he say under sworn testimony at that hearing that he had a South Carolina driver's license?
Yes, he did.
Okay, and did he say that he, when did he say he, did he say he last, that he owned any property or had a lease or when he last lived there?
I don't recall that he did that, and I apologize. I don't recall that that was discussed. It was more about that was where he went to school. That is where, to college. That's where
so
he
like
played.
Like 15 years earlier or
right,
something.
And then that's where his family lives, his parents and extended family members, except for his fiance, still lives in South Carolina. That's where he does conducts a lot of his business, has his driver's license there, and uses it for his mailing address. And importantly, the Japanese order, Miss Kia, used South Carolina as Mr. Jackson's address,
okay.
Acknowledging, recognizing that that's what he viewed as home.
And then besides his view, was there any record evidence about when he lived there? In other words, had a home or a lease, owned
no,
property?
No, there is
had
no,
a lease.
No record evidence that he had anything in South Carolina.
No, he could, an individual can be subject to personal jurisdiction based upon general jurisdiction as opposed to specific in more than one state, correct?
Correct, but that has to satisfy certain factors. There needs to be sufficient minimum contacts under due process law.
Right.
And it also, that there also needs to be a nexus or connection between the suit and the action.
That's for specific personal jurisdiction.
Sorry, correct, Your Honor, correct.
Right. We're talking about general yep. jurisdiction.
Right,
so he's,
right.
So he's got an apartment that he leases. I know there's a lot of emphasis on how many home games he played, but athletes have to practice. The practice facility is in Minnesota.
So actually,
what does the record tell us about non-game activity?
Right, and I would just point out that Mr. Jackson had just signed on with the Twins in February of 2024, and that was a couple of months before the registration was initiated in April. I think it was April 5th of 2024. It was sent to Mr. Jackson. He didn't receive it till April 19th because he wasn't here yet. And so as to your question, Your Honor, their practices are in Florida. And then the preseason, postseason practices are in Florida. For his purposes, just preseason because he lost his job. And then when they are here on home games, they don't practice between games. And I did not know that until this case. So they only practice on game day. And up to the point of the hearing, Mr. Jackson had only had about 22 game days in Minnesota, home games. And so therefore practices as well. And he really didn't spend a lot of time here outside of that. He has a partner and child in Utah, and he has family in South Carolina. And he also has a place in Florida because of the practices.
I'm assuming that there are cases from around the country. I didn't see much in the district court's decision or in the briefing where athletes are involved, and athletes who, like your client, travel for much of their professional experience and join teams and without any intent to reside in the state where they're playing. But what is the case, were you able to find, what's the closest case law that you're able to find, if any?
Yeah, I mean, I would say it looked like it was, you know, when we're looking at the child support laws, the contact that Mr. Jackson would have had to have had in this state, in the forum state, would have had to have been more sufficient than the 22 game days in an apartment here. And it was respondent's brief that pointed out it was employment law cases. And again, you know, those cases really go to, you know, the nexus between the lawsuit and the person's contacts. So in this case, a child support action isn't adequate. His employment here as a Minnesota twin is not connected or deriving to a child support action.
Here's what's troubling to me, and I'm speaking for myself and not for the panel, obviously. My concern is that the registration is initiated in Minnesota without enforcement. We're just registering. Then you, on behalf of your client, object to the registration and any future enforcement of the child support action and challenge personal jurisdiction. But you don't put any evidence in to say he's domiciled someplace else. You don't put any evidence, you know, I don't see the driver's license in the record. I see some exchange between you as counsel for Mr. Jackson and the district court about he considers South Carolina to be his home. He has a child and a partner in Utah. But Ms. Kia puts in evidence that he has a lease here. He's employed here. He's here on some kind of a regular basis, at least, at performing some services on behalf of a Minnesota corporation, appearing at Minnesota home games. I mean, it seems to me that the district court's evidence of domicile is evident, is that it is located in Minnesota. That's his residence, and that's where he intends to be, at least in the foreseeable future. And there's no other evidence that he intends to make his permanent residence someplace other than Minnesota. So I'm having a difficult time understanding why the factual record doesn't support a general jurisdiction conclusion.
Right,
help
right.
me out here.
And again, you know, I would say, kind of going back to the earlier part of your question, is Your Honor, is the subject matter jurisdiction is also lacking in the first place. And we argue about that in our motion, in our papers.
You mean the absence of a summons?
Well, yes. I mean, that is really the threshold issue here, that summons.
Can we just put a pin in that
deal
with the general jurisdiction issue?
Right, right.
Then we can, and I do want to get to the summons issue, but.
Yes, yes.
So when there has been affirmative evidence presented that his place of residence is here, his domicile is here, and he has an intention to stay here, you know, as long as his contract is in place, at least at the time of the file of the registration, why isn't that enough for the district court to say, in the absence of other evidence that he's domiciled someplace else, he's got to be domiciled here? That's
the
what the record
didn't
shows.
Really find that he was domiciled here, you know.
We're on de novo review, so why isn't it
right? And first of all, I would say the burden was on Ms. Kia to establish jurisdiction here in Minnesota. And Mr. Jackson, at that time, he, you know, again, back to the Japanese order, it said South Carolina. He stated in, you know, in court through me, we did have a discussion off, I think it was on the record, but she let me question my client, that he hadn't spent more than 22 days here in Minnesota. He viewed Minnesota as a fleeting place where he was going to work. He had played ball in four different teams in 4 years.
The goal, of course, is to land someplace. If you're a professional athlete, I mean, certainly they can bounce around, but the goal is to have a contract, to actually get the contract. And so the district court is faced with this, going to Judge Frisch's question about general jurisdiction. I mean, at the time, the district court is aware that he is a Minnesota twin. He is presumably intending to remain a Minnesota twin. He's entered into a lease in Minnesota to facilitate that objective. I'm trying to get a sense of why that's not enough in light of the fact that there wasn't an express declaration of domicile elsewhere.
Right, and the record doesn't really establish that it is Minnesota. The court even says that he lives in the United States, right? She doesn't say he lives in Minnesota. Mr. Jackson himself said, look, I don't know where I live, but my intention is not to live here. You know, I don't intend Minnesota.
Said that? I don't see that in
well,
the record.
Well, he did not say that verbatim, no, Your Honor.
The exchange that I have between you and the court is Mr. Jackson's home state is South Carolina. That's where he's from. That is where he went to college. That is where he grew up. And he spends a lot of time there. He has a fiance and a son in Utah. And with his recent release from the Twins, he doesn't know exactly. He needs to figure out what his next employment is going to be. I mean, that exchange doesn't tell me that he's domiciled somewhere other than Minnesota.
Right.
So is there any other evidence in the record that would indicate that he is domiciled? you know, given that the district court, you know, that we do have in the record, he's got a lease here and he's employed here and he's performing work here. Is there any other evidence in the record that would indicate that his domicile is someplace else?
I would say, other than what is in front of the court, it's no. But it is, South Carolina is, for all intents and purposes, where he lives in the United States.
Is
and
there some reason why there wasn't jurisdictional discovery in this case?
I don't know. I don't know why it wasn't served. So it wasn't, you know, we would have cooperated with it, and it was not served.
I mean, the difficulty I'm having is with, I mean, the exchange that with the district court, the evidence in front of the district court. I mean, why isn't Ms. Kaya stuck with this sort of whack-a-mole proposition where, okay, it's not Minnesota, but where is it?
Right.
Well, but he's from North Carolina, but there's no acknowledgement, no admission that, you know, he is domiciled. No, he's just from there. That's where he went to school. He's got family there, but that doesn't say anything really about his current domicile or intent to be domiciled in Minnesota. So the frustration is there no place where there's general jurisdiction?
And I would say no to that. In terms of the whack-a-mole happened before Minnesota, right? And as Ms. Kia testified, she tried to tag him in Canada. She tried to tag him in Georgia. She never tried South Carolina. I don't know why she didn't do that, but she didn't. And I would just say Minnesota doesn't have an interest in this case.
Be clear that the reference to North Carolina, reference to North Carolina, right? Not South.
South Carolina.
South Carolina, in the Japanese order, was entered at a time before he had a lease in Minnesota and began with the twins. Is that correct?
Correct, but he wasn't living in South Carolina. I think, to her knowledge, he wasn't even living in South Carolina at that point when she put that address down. She knew it was his home. He said it was his home in court. He views South Carolina as home.
I mean, he may view it there, and probably the reason he didn't serve him there is because he doesn't have a house there or a residence there.
He has a mailing address there. His driver's license does have an address on it, and that's where he receives his mail. That's where the Japanese order went, was to his parents' home. And his father does a lot of business for him. He helps him with all of his legal and professional affairs.
Can I just ask a question about the summons issue? It seems to me when I read the statute that there's that registration of the foreign order doesn't really do anything other than register the order. Isn't that right?
That is correct.
All right. There's no, it doesn't compel a response by your client or place your client in a position where liability would attach just by the virtue of the mere registration of the order. There would have to be a separate enforcement action.
That's
right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay.
Under UFSA, it's a ministerial action only, and that is reflected in the Scott v. Scott decision as well, that registration alone doesn't give rise to the enforcement or modification.
Thank you.
All right. And to that point, again, I just want to point out that, you know, this court doesn't even need to get to any of that because no summons was served in this case.
It'd be great to, and we did spend a lot of time on general jurisdiction, but unfortunately your time has expired.
Thank
so
you,
rather
Honor.
Than start a new discussion, perhaps we've got your brief on the question and you'll have an opportunity for rebuttal.
Okay, thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you. Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Michaela Wattenbarger, and I'm appearing on behalf of the respondent, Masami Kia. This case involves a professional athlete, or perhaps a former professional athlete, and a nursing maid nursing aide in Japan. More importantly, it involves a six-year-old child who deserves to receive the support of both of his parents, and indeed an order exists for that support, having been issued in December 2021 by the family court in Hiroshima, Japan, which was the place where the parties met and had their child. The Uniform Interstate Family Support Act, UIFSA, codified in Minnesota as Chapter 518C, provides a clear process for registering a foreign support order in Minnesota for purposes of enforcement, with a separate process to register for purposes of modification. In this case, respondent registered the Japanese child support order for enforcement on April 4th, 2024, and the district court affirmed the registration via order filed on August 27th, 2024, following a hearing.
Can I just stop you right there? I had a question about that registration for enforcement. What does that mean?
Registering the order to essentially domesticate the order in Minnesota, but only for purposes of enforcement, as opposed to there's a separate process set forth in UFSA to register it, to domesticate it for purposes of modification as well as enforcement.
So what did you do when you what was the relief you were requesting when you filed the petition in district court?
Petition and the responsive motion, which is requested the same relief, really were requesting registration. There was no affirmative enforcement relief requested at that time.
And so your position is that if you were seeking to affirmatively enforce the order from Japan, you would have to initiate some sort of separate proceeding or file a separate pleading, or how would that work?
No, the respondent did ultimately request enforcement relief,
yes,
by filing notice of intent to enter and docket child support judgment.
Yes.
On September 25th, 2024, which resulted in a judgment on September 27th. That was the specific enforcement relief that respondent requested.
And that was done separate, that's separate from the registration issue, which is before us on appeal.
That's correct.
And what is the due process requirement associated with the enforcement of the foreign judgment?
For the enforcement of foreign judgment, appellant had an opportunity to object to the entry of judgment. At that time, he could have responded with a motion regarding personal jurisdiction, regarding potentially a summons with respect to that enforcement action. He did not do that. He did request a stay enforcement while this appeal is pending, but he did not raise his request for relief relative to personal jurisdiction, relative to the summons with respect to that enforcement relief at that time.
And in any event, none of that is before us on appeal. Is that correct?
That's correct. Okay. The judgment has not been appealed.
All right.
It's at this point only the order affirming registration of foreign support order that is before this court on appeal.
Can I just ask you now about some general jurisdiction questions?
Of course.
Why is it that you did not conduct any jurisdictional discovery?
Your Honor, as we just discussed, what my client was requesting at that time was registration and registration only. Mm-hmm. According to the case law cited by appellant in his briefing, registration doesn't require personal jurisdiction, as it doesn't prejudice the rights of the obligor. We had not conducted jurisdictional discovery because at that point, personal jurisdiction wasn't required.
Yeah, the way I understand the statute is that once the petition is filed, the affected party can object to the petition, both the registration of the petition and the enforcement of the petition, which is a little bit anomalous. And in that objection, personal jurisdiction was raised. So once personal jurisdiction is raised, my question again to you is, why didn't you conduct any jurisdictional discovery?
At what point? At the point of the filing of the petition? Oh,
of the objection that's authorized by statute to both registration and enforcement.
The objection to the notice, correct, back in April?
Well, I think that the objection was twofold that was filed on his behalf.
Well, I guess, again, because at that point, enforcement wasn't being requested. Personal jurisdiction is relevant to the issue of enforcement, but that was not the issue that was being pursued at that time, so discovery was not conducted.
And why is it enough to establish domicile by submit? Why is the fact that he had a lease here, a 6-month lease here, and appeared at a handful of home games, why is that enough to establish that he was domiciled in Minnesota? I mean, his employment at, you know, with the twins, he executed that contract in various locations, Florida, other jurisdictions, et cetera. So why is it enough to establish domicile here?
Your Honor, I think the answer to that really is that that's the only evidence that existed as to where he had a home base, a domicile. The information, all of the information before the court, all of the record information, is that appellant rented a lease, stayed in Minnesota at least four games, if not at other times. He had an employment relationship with the Twins or the Saints, spent time in Minnesota. There was no sworn evidence.
Is that enough to establish that he had an intention to remain here permanently? Because as I understand it, that is a requirement to establish a domicile.
I think in the absence of evidence that he had a specific intention to remain elsewhere, the court did not abuse its discretion by finding that it was.
And whose burden is it to establish personal jurisdiction?
It is respondents. It was respondents for purposes of enforcement.
I'm having a difficult time squaring your last two answers, how the absence of evidence can satisfy your affirmative burden to establish jurisdiction.
I would say there is evidence. There is evidence, and in the absence of other evidence, that it's sufficient. There is evidence that appellant resided in Minnesota. He had a lease. He had games. He had practices, presumably meetings. At the hearing, the August hearing, that hearing was held remotely via Zoom, and he was in Minnesota for that hearing, although he was not required to be, and although he was, as I understand it, no longer employed by the Twins, by the Saints. He had a home base here. That was the record evidence before the court.
Can I ask you about that record evidence? Because I'm not seeing any. Maybe it wasn't prepared, or maybe it's my failure to find. I'm not seeing a transcript of an evidentiary hearing in which Sir Jackson provided testimony under oath.
You're correct, Your Honor.
There was no such. So the record evidence, he did swear under oath to his affidavits.
Correct.
Is that the full testimony from Mr. Jackson that's available in the record?
That's correct,
Your Honor. The affidavit testimony.
Correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Because registration is the issue that's before this court today, respondent would submit that the relevant questions that must be addressed are, one, whether the Japanese child support order qualifies as a foreign support order such that registration under UFSA is permitted, and two, whether respondent was required to personally serve a summons for registration purposes.
May I just back up for 1 second, and I'm sorry that you switched to a new topic. Can you just tell me which date, relative to what we were just discussing about registration, et cetera, on which date should the district court and should we be looking at for whether there was personal jurisdiction? In other words, when
the relevant date from respondent's perspective would be the date on which she sought affirmative enforcement relief,
which would be
September 25th, 2024, when she filed the notice of intent to enter judgment and docket child support.
So if it's September 25th of 2024, and if domicile requires an intent to remain somewhere indefinitely, earlier when he had a one-year guaranteed contract, but then he got let go, why in September of 2024 would there be an intent to remain in Minnesota indefinitely, even if arguably there was before because he hoped to stay with the Twins?
And Your Honor, I don't know that we have information regarding his status in September 2024. At that point, the court had found that there was sufficient personal the court had made a personal jurisdiction determination.
Well, that's my question process. Is when does it should it be made? What evidence should be considered?
I think the evidence that should be considered, well, first, I want to say that judgment resulting from the September 25th, 2024 notice is not before this court. If it were, I think that that is the appropriate date to look at, because that is when affirmative enforcement relief was being sought, was that date. And I don't know that we have information regarding what his status was in September 2024. So I don't know that I can answer your question.
Oh. I mean, do we have information about his employment at that time?
Not in September of 2024. Mr. Jackson represented that he was would no longer be with the twins.
Okay.
But we don't know what, I guess, what he did after August 2024.
I see. But we knew it was not with the twins anymore. He had been let go after, by then.
That's correct.
Okay, thanks.
So first, with respect to whether the Japanese child support order qualifies as a foreign support order, such that registration under UIFSA is permitted, respondent would submit that the district court properly found that it does. Under UIFSA, a foreign support order is defined as a support order issued by a court of a foreign country. And whether Japan qualifies as a foreign country under the UIFSA definition ultimately comes down to whether Japan has enacted child support laws and procedures similar to those in place in Minnesota.
I want to ask you a few questions. I'm sorry to pivot your attention, but I do have some questions about the due process requirement associated with notifying Mr. Jackson that this registration proceeding has been petitioned before the district court. What is the requirement that he be notified that the petition has been filed? Is there no requirement?
So it's not, I want to clarify, it's not a petition that initiates a registration action. Under UIFSA, there is there's a handful of documents that are required to submit under UIFSA. It's an affidavit from the obligee regarding information that she has about the obligor, his current address, his current employment, the amount of any arrears, attaching the relevant foreign order that is sought to be registered.
But there's something that's filed with the district court, and that's the petition. And so what's the requirement that he be notified that a petition involving him has been submitted to the district court for registration?
So under UIFSA, not to pick apart words, but it's not a petition. Under UIFSA, she files these documents. The court administration issues a notice of registration. That is the notice that is required under UIFSA, and he did receive that. The court administration issued the notice. He received that notice. The notice provided him with information regarding how long he had to object to registration of the order, notifying him that if he did not object and establish one of eight grounds for objecting, that it would be registered.
I mean, 518C301, proceedings under this chapter, Part B, an individual petitioner or support enforcement agency may commence a proceeding authorized under this chapter by filing a petition in an initiating tribunal for forwarding to a respondent tribunal, or filing a petition or comparable pleading directly in a tribunal of another state or foreign country.
So
I just need to know, how is he notified? What's the requirement that he be notified? Or is there none?
And Your Honor, 518C.602 is specifically the provision that sets forth a procedure to register an order for enforcement purposes. It sets forth, I think, five documents that the obligee is required to submit. And 518 to the district court. 518C.605 is regarding the notice of registration of order that's issued by the court administration.
So in your view, your client has zero obligation to notify Mr. Jackson that these documents have been filed in the district court?
For registration purposes, yes, that's correct.
And the notice only has to come from the district court after the registration has already taken effect?
That's correct, Your Honor.
How does that comport with his due process rights, given that the proceeding affects him?
Well, as set forth in Scott v. Scott and Kasdan v. Burney, this court has found the registration does not prejudice the rights of the obligor. And that's why under Scott v. Scott, this court specifically found that personal jurisdiction isn't required for registration because registration by itself does not prejudice his rights.
So that may be the case if registration in a vacuum, like a tree falls in the forest and no one's there to hear it, right? So, but this is a registration for enforcement purposes. And that is actually how your client commenced this, or how the documents were presented to the district court. So that for enforcement purposes seems to affect his going forward rights.
And Your Honor, when she sought affirmative enforcement relief, I think all of these questions are fair game. I think there is a question whether or not Minnesota has general, specific, limited personal jurisdiction over the appellant. I think there's a question of whether or not the notice needed to have been personally served as a summons for commencement of that enforcement piece. There, I think those are legitimate questions when it comes to the specific enforcement relief that she requested. But
sorry, I have one more question.
Please go on.
It's
the last case on our calendar, so we can go all afternoon.
Keep me here all day.
I'm not really trying to mince words, but I mean the petition. I mean, is there a difference between just a straight registration and a registration for enforcement purposes? I mean, that those seem to be two different things.
Your Honor, I do think that registration in a vacuum is what's called, I think UFSA sets forth the process for registration, period. Then once it's registered for enforcement, persons seeking enforcement can seek specific enforcement relief. There's also under the next section of UFSA, a process for once registration has been completed, using really the same process, a process for then seeking modification of the registered order. So I do think that they're two separate and distinct pieces here, registration and then what happens next.
Does it matter that the initiating documents in the district court use the word enforcement in it?
I think the use of the word enforcement is to differentiate between having it registered for enforcement only versus for modification. And if you look at the two provisions, registration for enforcement and the section on modification, the section on modification, there's an affirmative requirement for the court to make findings that the district court has personal jurisdiction. Whereas the process for registration alone, personal jurisdiction of the court where the order is being registered it's not even one of the bases.
I just want to try to understand. So then, with a petition or action to register for enforcement without notice, when would the subject of that registration be able to raise a due process challenge under lack of personal jurisdiction?
Upon affirmative enforcement relief being sought, which in this case would have been in September 2024.
And then you filed the statute to look at that governed your filing of a petition in September 2024 is what statute?
I'm sorry, can you
repeat the question? What statute outlines it? I understand your argument about the registration and when we look at that and what's required there. When you decided, oh, all right, now I'm going to petition for enforcement, what framework statutorily were you operating under?
We filed it as a notice of intent to enter judgment and docket child support. I don't know off the top of my head what statute governs.
So it's outside of the statute. Correct. You're following, now it's registered as a judgment here, and now you're following a framework to enforce that which is registered.
That's correct. Under UFSA, once an order is registered, it can be enforced as any other judgment under Minnesota law, and so that process is outside of UFSA. It's just a process that's provided for enforcement of any Minnesota child support judgment.
Gotcha.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any rebuttal?
Thanks, Your Honor. I have to point out what happened here. You know, after enforcement was requested, a judgment ensued, and that is what is being appealed. The requirement that only notice needs to be provided to a party is not the same. It's in Scott v. Scott. It says if you seek to registration, fine. You know, that's one thing. It's ministerial. But when a party is seeking to enforce or modify, that's another thing, and that requires a summons, and that didn't happen here.
And when did that happen, though? Did that happen after the district court issued the notice that the petition had been, or that the registration had been accepted?
So the when did he get served?
No, when did the enforcement action commence?
I would say it happened before the argument at district court on August 19th. Ms. Kia served a petition, sent it through mail to through email to Mr. Jackson, so and filed it with the court. It was apparent there that she intended to seek enforcement, and that's what happened here. That's what resulted in that the August 27th order. The court decided to enforce.
But there was a separate initiating document requesting the court to do something after the initial documents were filed with the district
court.
Correct.
It was never served on Mr. Jackson. Correct. And it was never served with a summons.
Okay. And is that second set of things that happened, the enforcement piece of it, is that before us on appeal?
Sorry, the enforcement piece is not that the order of the court ordering judgment on Mr. Jackson when it had no jurisdiction, no summons, is what is on appeal. But it certainly reflects back to Ms. Kia's intent when she registered.
I'm sorry, I really am confused. So let's pretend that there was no petition filed ever, and all that was all that happened is in compliance with point 601.
Just registration.
Registration. Then the district court would have registered the judgment.
And yes, as it did.
As it did. Okay. And then, so when you say, so what judge, and that would not, that's not what's on appeal here, the registration of the judgment.
It is actually.
So let's pretend, what would be wrong with that?
So there, because Japan is not a foreign state for purposes of UFSA, it does not, it doesn't have to exactly match Minnesota law, but it does not line up with Minnesota law, particularly with regard to enforcement. In Japan, they can't.
Okay, so statutorily you say it doesn't qualify, but it's not a problem of there being a lack of summons.
Correct. No summons is required. What Ms. Wattenberger says about registration, because it's ministerial, it only requires U.S. mail. And that is what the court properly did in sending that to Mr. Jackson with the notice that he can object to having the registration, which is what he did. He never waived his arguments about personal jurisdiction here. But when it comes to enforcement and being hailed into the court in this state of Minnesota, you absolutely have to have a summons, and that was never served on Mr. Jackson, and that is fatal to this case.
I'm sorry, I just need to clarify. I thought the August 27 order is the thing that we are reviewing on appeal.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, and when I read that order, I do not see an order enforcing the judgment in Japan. I only see that it shall remain registered for enforcement purposes, but it's not affirmatively enforcing the order.
Correct, and that happens in September. But we have to go all the way back to this because the court had no, it was incorrect for the court to enforce that order. And if the court looks at the expert testimony of Ms. Ayoko Ikeda, she is an esteemed international Family Lawyer Academy fellow, and she opines as an expert about how Japan does not utilize enforcement mechanisms, the ones that Ms. Kia is seeking to have Minnesota enforce on Mr. Jackson here. She couldn't get in her own country.
What if we disagreed with you on that? What's wrong with this order?
There is no basis to, first of all, there's no basis to base so Ms. Kia sets forth her own advocate's opinion, her Japanese lawyer's opinion about Minnesota law versus Japanese law. That's it. And that is what the court relies on. And it's
right, but let's say go up a level. Let's say we disagree with you. What's wrong with the order on appeal?
It finding that Japanese law and Minnesota law are similar, finding that finding that Minnesota has jurisdiction over Mr. Jackson.
So you say then it's still that there needed to be personal jurisdiction over him, even though it's just a registration action.
When we are getting to the point of enforcement, because Ms. Kia is asking the courts to send the order on for enforcement, or she's queuing it up for enforcement here.
Does this order, where in this order does it enforce it?
It doesn't strictly say that it's enforcing it, but Ms. Kia then went from that order and docketed a judgment.
Right. I mean, people docket the judgments, I presume, whether, sorry, I'm going over it. Enforce it or to change it. I don't know what else one would do with it. I mean, it's not that interesting just to docket it, I suppose. So the fact that you're going to do that, why doesn't that then, how is that different? Once you have a docketed foreign judgment versus a local judgment, then you try and enforce it, and then those rules apply.
Right.
I'm trying to figure out why we're even in that world, right, if what we're only looking at is the docketing.
Minnesota has no interest in docketing a judgment, in having any enforcement mechanisms imposed on Mr. Jackson here.
Is that a challenge to the statute then? Like the constitutionality of the statute, that as you file X, Y, and Z?
It's not a constitutional question, Your Honor. It's just propriety of Mr. Jackson. There is no jurisdiction over Mr. Jackson to implement any of our enforcement mechanisms in this state against him.
But that doesn't include docketing, or does include docketing? Is that of the
right
judgment?
Well, Mr. Jackson needs to be hailed into this court of this state through a summons to be forced to pay the judgment.
Right, but for the small part of just docketing, the district court docketing the foreign judgment, you're conceding, I gather, there's no need for personal jurisdiction for that part of it.
Correct, for the docketing, correct.
And we get beyond that here because there was a further attempt to do what with regard to enforcement?
Well, the judgment was docketed, and presumably there's going to be enforcement action therefrom against Mr. Jackson in Minnesota.
Which there would have to be personal jurisdiction.
Correct.
I'm just wondering about the ripeness of that concern. I mean,
right.
And so can you explore that with us for a moment? Why would we deal with that now?
I think, the concern is that Mr. Jackson could be, if he finds himself in Minnesota again, he could, eventually things could happen to him. Like his, he could be held in contempt. He could be pursued by Ms. Kia further.
But only if there's enforcement.
Correct.
I guess I'm trying to get a sense of the ripeness of the challenge to enforcement if there's been no actual enforcement determined by the district court, if all we're talking about is a judgment. Can you?
Right. Yeah, I'm tracking, Your Honor. I hear you. I have nothing further to say on that.
Okay.
Okay.
It doesn't appear to be any further questions. Thank you both.
Thanks.
For your argument today. Hopefully you could hear us. I'm sorry for the challenges of the audio. Although now?
Yeah.
It's quiet now that we're done.
We said something about it, and that was all it took.
Thank you both for your argument, for your written argument. It's a very interesting case. We will issue our opinion within the statutory period. That is our last case on for our calendar for oral argument today, so we are in recess. Thank you. Have a great day.
All right.